Kind of pick up where we left off, and believe me, it'll go much faster because the first three chapters are full of most of the message of the book, which is why they get so much commentary. And also, it's a long introduction, but the rest actually can go rather quickly. We're not going to by any means go verse by verse. We advertise this as an introduction and an overview of the book. Now, we've talked about chapters 1 and 2. Chapter 1 had the history of Hosea marrying and having children. And chapter 2, in the beginning of it, the first, verses 2 through 13, is sort of a lambast of Israel for her various crimes and God really making his case of why he's separating from her. And, he began that in verse 2 of chapter 2, bring charges against your mother. And he's going to use that term again in chapter 4, eventually here in verse 1. Where he's going to say, the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of Israel. So these are the charges. And then I'm not going to go over them, but I will say this, that you find that if you read through the book of Hosea, the things that God was complaining about are their idolatry, which he refers to as harlotry. Harlotry is a code word for idolatry when you're talking about Israel and God, because God and Israel are married, or were, and she slept with too many men, and so he put her away, he said. He says, for example, as you read through, they've done a lot of different crimes. They've rejected the prophets. They've been treacherous against the covenant. Their priests and their prophets, that is, their false prophets, and the people are all pretty much compromised in this deal. They've all departed from God. The main thing he keeps saying is there's no knowledge of God. He begins talking that way in chapter 4, but he does have, at the end of each of the first three chapters, as I mentioned, a section about the messianic salvation, messianic age, when the Messiah would come and gather the true Israel, the faithful remnant, to himself and bring salvation. Now, we mentioned just before taking a break that in chapter 2, verse 23, which is one of these salvation sections, he has made a play on words of the second and third child of Hosea. The second and third children are the ones who represent Israel in alienation from God because of harlotry. And he says, I will have mercy on her who had not obtained mercy. I will say to those who were not my people, you are my people, and they shall say, you are my God. So if he's going to say that to people who were not his people and who had never previously received mercy, that includes Gentiles. Certainly, if anyone had not been his people, it's the Gentiles. The Jews had been. But he's, of course, talking about the faithful Jews would be shown mercy, those who come to Christ, and Gentiles too, people who had not been his people before, would now be his people. And that is, of course, what has become true since the death, resurrection of Christ and his enthronement at the right hand of God, where he is sitting at God's right hand till all his enemies are brought under his feet. We were once his enemies. We've been brought under his feet. We now serve him. And that's his mission during this past 2,000 years until he returns. Now, chapter 3 then is very short, and it finishes up the story of Hosea. So then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by a lover and is committing adultery, just like the love of the Lord for the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love the raisin cakes of the pagan. Now, the raisin cakes is something that was eaten in the idolatrous feast, possibly with some think it was an aphrodisiac that would be used to sleep with temple prostitutes and things like that. Anyway, he's saying that they love those more than they love God. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and 1.5 omers, or excuse me, 1/2 omers of barley. Now, under the law, the price of a slave, if one was gored by an ox and you had to make restitution because it was your ox and someone else a slave, the restitution was 30 pieces of silver. That's how much, of course, Judas betrayed Jesus for, as if he were a common slave. But here, she's being bought at budget price, 15 shekels, that's half price. Of course, there's some bushels of grain here to make up the difference. I don't know if they did make up the difference, or if they were just, incentive for the seller to let her be sold at the low price. It may be that she's being bought at half the price of an ordinary slave because she's damaged goods, and she's not of that much value, especially if the person selling her is a pimp. You know, I mean, after a few years of that kind of lifestyle, it might be that customers are looking for someone a little less used up. And so she's less desirable, and yet Hosea takes her back at God's instruction. And he said, I said to her, you shall stay with me many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. Thus I will also be toward you. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim. Afterward the children of Israel shall return, seek the Lord, their God, and David, their king, which is the name for the Messiah. And I'll explain that in a moment. And fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. Now, the term the latter days has been commonly used in popular eschatological preaching to usually just kind of, you see latter days or last days, we just say, oh, that's like, in the tribulation, or that's like just before Jesus comes back, that's the latter days. Unfortunately, it's not that easy. When the Old Testament uses the term latter days, or even last days, it's not always talking about the same days. A lot of times it's just talking about days later than these. So, latter days often refers to just days later than the person talking. In fact, the term last days refers to the time of the first coming of Jesus. We know that because of many references in the New Testament, like Hebrews chapter 1, which says, God, who at sundry times in diverse manners spoke to our fathers in time past through the prophets, has spoken to us in these last days by his Son. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9 that we are those, he's speaking of himself and his readers, we are those who live at the end of the ages. John in 1 John chapter 2 said, Beloved, it is the last hour. And as you've heard that Antichrist shall come, even now there are many Antichrists whereby we know that it is the last hour. Peter said that Jesus, in 1 Peter 1, he said, Jesus was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last days, or in the last days. James told the rich of his day that they had laid up treasures in the last days. So all the New Testament writers indicated that they and their readers were living in the last days. Latter days is less specific. Latter days just means times later than the speaker. The term last days usually refers to the last days, I believe, of the Second Temple, of the Jewish order, the destruction of the Old Covenant and the coming of the New. That's, if you look at all the times when the New Testament writers refer to the last days, there's a good chance that that's what they're referring to. I won't press that too hard, but I will say this, that the term in the latter days, that does not mean at the end of time. That just means later. You'll understand this later. This will happen later, not now. Now, what is it that's going to happen later and not now? Well, he said to his wife when he took her back, you will stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. Thus I will also be toward you. Now, when he says you'll not play the harlot, neither will you have a man, he might mean any other man than him. He might mean that, she's had a lot of men, but now you're going to be faithful to me and you're not going to have any men. And I'll be saying to you, I'll be faithful to you too. But there's many who read it, many scholars have felt that it's saying that for many days after he took her back, they themselves will be abstinent. You won't have a man, including me, he's saying. You will be without sex. You'll have to live chaste for a while. Maybe this is to see how her health was. Maybe this is to see if she's pregnant. There might have been sort of a, you're coming back, but we're not going to rejoin quite immediately here. Let's just, we'll go some days with abstinence before we, rejoin. So it could be either way. He, what he says, you will not have a man. not clear if it means any man, including him, for a while. And he'll abstain too. I mean, it's going to be as hard on him as her, but maybe harder. But there's difference of opinion. You don't have to know the answer to that, but the point is that this being without a man for many days means that there hasn't been quite the full restoration. And it seems to be interpreted in verse 4, for the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king, without a prince, without a sacrifice or a sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim. Now, some of these things sound like good things, kings, princes, an altar, a pillar, ephod. An ephod was what the priest wore in the temple over his robe. It was a sort of a tunic that went over his robe. But ephods were also used for idolatry. In the book of Judges, for example, when Gideon had delivered the people from the Midianites, the people offered him kingship, and he refused. He says, I will not reign over you. The Lord will reign over you. But he says, I do want an ephod. Give me an ephod. Now, we don't know what he wanted that for, but he never served as priest, so I don't know why he wanted the ephod, but it says in Judges chapter 8 that in later times, in latter days, the Israelites worshipped the ephod. It became an idol to them. Now, at the end of the book of Judges, there's a man named Micah who's a Levite. He gets himself an ephod, and he sets it up to worship an idol. So apparently the ephod that Aaron, the high priest, wore was either other religions had similar garments and called them by the same name, or maybe they imitated Aaron's priesthood, but these were not the real ephod of the real priest. And when he says you'll be without an ephod, he's probably not referring to without an Aaronic priest, but probably without false priests, because he talks about teraphim also, and teraphim are images, which the Bible does not, the Old Testament would not allow. So he's saying you're not going to have these idolatrous things, idolatrous priests and ephods and altars and so forth. You're not going to practice idolatry. You also won't have a king for that period of time. Now, interestingly, in Old Testament times, after the destruction of the Northern Kingdom, they never did have a king again. Though, as I said, some individuals, a remnant of the 10 northern tribes, had, prior to the Assyrian invasion, they had migrated to Judah. We read about that in the book of Chronicles several times, that there were migrations of people from the north who didn't like the paganism, and they wanted to worship in Jerusalem, so they became Judahites. They came back to Judah. And therefore, when the Northern Kingdom was destroyed, all Jews of every tribe were called Judah. And that's why they're all called Jews later on, because the name comes from Judah. Now, even Judah was without a king after it went into Babylon. They came back from Babylon. Zerubbabel was a descendant from the kings of Judah, but he was not a king. And they never really had a Jewish king until Jesus came. They did have a king of the Jews named Herod, but he was not Jewish. He was an Edomite. Prior to Herod, there were some what they call the Hasmonean dynasty, which were priests, not Judahites. They didn't have a Jewish king until Jesus came, the king of the Jews. He who was born, as the wise men said, king of the Jews. So there's a prediction here that there'd be a long period of time where Israel, after their destruction, would not have a king. But then they would. This would have to be, I think, after the destruction of both nations. They never had a king again until Jesus came. And that king, it says in verse 5, afterward the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God, and David their king, and fear the Lord in his goodness in the latter days. Now, the reference to David the king. Some people have said, well, this refers to the millennial reign, and when Jesus comes back and everyone's raised from the dead, then David will reign. After all, why not? He reigned, 1,000 years before Christ. Why not 2,000 years after Christ? If Jesus comes back and sets up a 1,000-year reign, why can't David rule there? Well, mainly because most of the scriptures, the Messiah is going to rule during the Messianic age. And yet, there are three other places in the Old Testament that refer to the Messiah as David. One of them is in Jeremiah chapter 30. And verse 9, which is messianic, and it says, but they shall serve the Lord their God and David their king, whom I will raise up for them. So, again, it's referring to the Messiah. They'll serve him. Likewise, in Ezekiel, both chapter 34 and 37, Ezekiel 34, verse 22, says, "Therefore I will save my flock, and they shall no longer be prey, and I will judge between sheep and sheep. I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. He shall feed them and be their shepherd." Now, the wording of this passage should sound very familiar. It sounds not like John chapter 10, where it says, "I will save my flock, they shall no longer be a prey, I will judge between sheep and sheep." It says, verse 23 is good. "I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David." He also mentions them as his flock in that earlier verse too, "save my flock." In John 10, Jesus told his disciples, "I have other sheep that you don't know about." This is after he said, "I'm the good shepherd," referring to this passage. "So I'm the good shepherd of the sheep." And he later says, "I have other sheep that you don't know about. I'm going to go and bring them also, and there will be one flock and one shepherd." That is, he's going to bring the Gentiles as well as the Jews, the believing Jews, the believing Gentiles, bring them into his kingdom, into his church, and there will be one flock with one shepherd. That's the language Jesus used, and that's what it says here. "I will establish one shepherd over them, and they'll be my flock, and my servant David." That's Jesus. Why would he be called David here? By the way, there's one other reference to Messiah as David over in chapter Ezekiel 37, verse 24. Why? Well, because, first of all, God didn't reveal the real name of the Messiah in the Old Testament. Just like when he talked about John the Baptist in Malachi chapter 4, he called him Elijah. Why? Elijah is a type of John the Baptist. David is a type of the Messiah. The real names of Jesus and John the Baptist were not revealed until New Testament times, but they were referred to a couple times as code names. In this case, David. Why? Because David was not only the name of a man, but of a dynasty. The house of David. Every king of the house of David could be called David. For example, David's grandson, Rehoboam, when he made a policy that the people of Israel didn't like that caused the division of the two nations from each other, they said as they left, "See to your own house, O David." They called Rehoboam David. He wasn't David. He wasn't even David's son. He was his grandson. But he was the king who sat on David's throne. He was the successor of David. And David was a dynasty. God had promised David that a son of his would sit on his throne forever after him. A dynasty that would never end, and the Messiah would be of that. So the Messiah, like every king descended from David, can be called David. And David is indeed a type of the Messiah. So referring to him, Hosea, Isaiah, and Ezekiel all refer to the Messiah as David. But there's another thing to observe. I said these passages in Hosea are talking about the present age and Jesus reigning. He's David reigning over his flock now. Well, he certainly identified himself as the one who's the shepherd over his one flock, in his own words. But more than that, let me show you something in 2 Samuel chapter 7, which is the first time that God promised David that the Messiah would be his offspring. This is the promise. This is the whole foundation for the Jewish hope that the Messiah will be descended from David, and the Christian belief that he was descended from David. It's this passage when David wanted to build a temple, a house for God. And God says, "No, I don't think so. I didn't ask you to build me a house, but I'll build you a house." And by house, he meant a dynasty, the house of David. And so this is where this prophecy comes from about the Messiah being descended from David. And every Jew, every rabbi sees it this way. There's not many things rabbis agree about, but they agree about this. You get three Jews, you got four opinions. It's hard to find rabbis who agree with each other, but they agree on this. It's a universal belief. David is told this: "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build a house for my name," which is the church, made of living stone. "And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son." And it goes on. Now, this prophecy has some fulfillment in Solomon, but not ultimate. That statement, "I'll be his father, he'll be for me his son," that's quoted in Hebrews 1:5 as referring to Jesus. The writer says, to which of the angels did God ever say, he shall be my son, I'll be your father? He's quoting this passage. He's implying, God said this to Jesus. This is Jesus that's being talked about. Solomon, like David himself, is a type of Christ. And the prophecy is about the Messiah. And it says that this Messiah will be raised up while David is sleeping in his grave. That's what he says. When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I'll set up your seat after you. Now, this can't be in a future millennium, because in the millennium, if Jesus is going to come and set up a millennial kingdom, David won't be asleep anymore. He'll be out of his grave like everybody else. When Jesus comes, he's going to raise the dead. David will raise when Jesus comes back. So if there's a 1,000-year reign after that, and David reigns, or David's seed reigns, it doesn't meet the conditions of the prophecy. The prophecy says this will happen while David is asleep with his fathers, that God will raise up his seed reign after him. And Peter exploits that wording in Acts chapter 2, when he's quoting from David about the Messiah. In fact, just starting in Acts chapter 2, verse 27, Peter is preaching, he's quoting from Psalm 16, one of David's psalms. Acts 2:27 says, because you will not leave my soul in Hades, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of joy with your presence. Then Peter says about that, men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. In other words, the conditions for the coming of the Messiah are met, according to 2 Samuel 7:12. It said, what happened when David is dead and when he's sleeping with his fathers? Peter says, well, he's dead, he's buried, his tomb is here. This is the time, isn't it? This is the time that was prophesied. He says, therefore, being a prophet, knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him, that of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Messiah to sit on his throne. He, foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection of Christ. And then it says in verse 32, this Jesus God has raised up, of which we're all witnesses. So God promised David he would raise up a seed of his to reign while he's dead in the tomb. And this Jesus, he has in fact fulfilled the promise, because this Jesus he has raised up. And David is in the tomb. So what Peter says is the promise of the messianic kingdom that God would establish forever with one of David's sons is now fulfilled with the rising up of Jesus, who's of the seed of David. And David's in his tomb. So the promise cannot be applied to a future time after Jesus comes back, because David won't be in his tomb anymore. He'll be raised. So anyway, frankly, the entire New Testament is consistent in always applying such prophecies to the present age, although it's more popular, especially for those who decide that the Jews who crucified Jesus, I guess, understood the prophecies better than the apostles, whom Jesus opened their understanding that they might understand the scriptures. Some people think this is yet to be fulfilled. This is actually the present time. Jesus is the shepherd. Jesus has gone to the Gentiles and still does to bring them to him, the sheep that the Jews didn't know about, along with his remnant disciples among the Jews. Jews and Gentiles together, God's broken down the middle wall of partition and made himself one new man in Christ. Okay, so this is one of the passages about the kingdom or the Messiah's age too. Now, I'm going to just dash through some summaries of chapters 4 through 13 because I want to take a little bit of time with chapter 14, which is another messianic passage. These passages in between have several things about them that might make them hard to understand. And by the way, if you're looking at the notes, I'm skipping over some of them. I'm on the back side now. There's a number of place and people's names that might be unfamiliar or used in an unfamiliar way. 32 times in the book of Hosea, the name Ephraim appears. Ephraim was one of the tribes of the northern kingdom. It was the biggest. It was the predominant son of Joseph. When Joseph's tribe was divided into two, Ephraim and Manasseh, Ephraim was the more predominant of the two. And it apparently became the very largest tribe of the ten in the north. And therefore, just like the southern kingdom, which had two tribes, Benjamin and Judah, it was called Judah because Judah was hugely larger than Benjamin. Therefore, although there were two tribes there, they just called the whole country Judah after the larger tribe. So also the northern kingdom had one tribe that was much larger and more prominent than the others, and that was Ephraim. So sometimes the nation to the north is called Ephraim, even though Ephraim technically is only one of the 10 tribes, not the whole nation. But Hosea is one who uses the word Ephraim instead of Israel, although the name Israel appears in Hosea 2, but 32 times. This is unusual for the prophets to do that. Now, the name Ephraim means double fruitfulness. And there's a theme going through Hosea of God sowing. First of all, scattering Israel in judgment, but later he'll sow them to produce fruit, and the fruit, the earth's going to bring forth its fruit. The idea of Israel being fruitful is an important concept in the Old and the New Testament. God's vineyard that he wanted to get good grapes from, he got sour grapes, so he tore down the vineyard. God's fig tree, which didn't produce, but Jesus cursed it. He said, no one will ever eat fruit from you again. God's olive tree. Olive tree is the image of Israel. And also, cultivated land as opposed to wilderness. In the prophets, the idea of wilderness refers to land that no one has taken care of. And the Gentile world, or even Israel when they're banished, under God's judgment, are likened to thorns and thistles and wilderness and so forth. But there's also predictions that God would pour out rivers in the desert and waters in the wilderness. And in Isaiah, these are identified as God pouring out his spirit, which he did at Pentecost. But then the wilderness becomes fruitful. And this is all spiritual. The New Testament talks about fruit of the spirit. Jesus even talks about Israel as a vineyard, which the tenants didn't provide the fruit to the owners, so he destroyed them and leased it out to others who would bear the fruit of it, meaning the true followers of Christ will bear the fruit. Now, this is not, fruit like you buy at a market. This is spiritual fruit. And so the imagery of God sowing, seeking a harvest, the expressions of harvest, of fruitfulness, sowing, Jezreel means God sows. These are some of the themes that are there a lot. And even the name Ephraim, as a name for Israel, means double fruitfulness. That's what the name Israel means. I mean, not Israel, but Ephraim. Now, another word we've already talked about is Jezreel. We've seen the occasions where that occurs. We're not going to look at them again. But if you hadn't been told what Jezreel means, that's a very confusing part of the first chapter of Hosea. What in the world is the blood of Jezreel and so forth? Well, we talked about that. Another thing is you'll find three times in the book the name Beth-Aven or Beth-Aven. There's two opinions about this. There's actually in the Old Testament in Judges or in Joshua a mention of a town called Beth-Aven, this very name. And it is said to be in the region of Bethel and Ai. And so it might seem natural to assume that whenever it talks about Beth-Aven here, it's talking about that town. But there's a peculiarity in the interpretation of the word Aven. Beth-Aven literally means house of wickedness. Now, most commentators, in fact, all the ones I've encountered, feel that when Hosea uses the term Beth-Aven, he's not speaking of a town near Bethel called Beth-Aven. He's talking about Bethel. He's given it a symbolic name, just like in Revelation 11:8. It says that the city of Jerusalem, where Christ was crucified, is spiritually called Egypt and Sodom. It says, sometimes people are Israel and their cities can be given names that are play on words to their real name. Bethel means house of God. Beth-Aven means house of wickedness. Now, Bethel is one of the two places where the golden calves were set up by Jeroboam in Israel. So it was a place where the Israelites went to worship a golden calf. And it's virtually every commentator I've encountered has said that Beth-Aven is a pejorative nickname for Bethel, though there actually was a town called Beth-Aven or two. But I think the commentators are probably right, because I believe it's a play on words that it's no longer the house of God, Bethel. It's a house of wickedness because a calf is worshipped there instead of God. Gilgal is mentioned a few times, three times, and God's he talks about his anger at Gilgal. And this is apparently a reference to the fact that that's where Saul was made king. Now, there's a number of references in Hosea to Israel's seeking a king in Saul, and of God's anger at them doing so. And so this is, I think, probably Gilgal, though there's other things did happen at Gilgal also, because of the repeated theme of the evil choice of a king in Saul, that this is where Gilgal's offense is said to be. Let me show you some things. Both references to Gilgal, but also references to them seeking a king. In chapter 8 and verse 4, he says, "They set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, and I did not acknowledge it." Now, we could say, but God did set up Saul. Yeah, God did set up Saul because they insisted upon it. And he said, okay, I'll give you a king, but you're not going to be happy about it. And later on, he says in chapter 13, verses 10 and 11, Hosea 13, 10 and 11, it says, "I will be your king." Well, I should go to verse 9. "O Israel, you are destroyed by your help, but your help is from me. I will be your king. Where is any other that you may that may save you in all your cities and your judges to whom you said, 'Give us a king and princes'? I gave you a king in my anger and took him away in my wrath." Now, when they said, "Give us a king," that's 1 Samuel chapter 8, when they asked for a king for the first time in Israel, and Saul was given it. He said, "I gave you a king, but I was angry about it, and I took him away in my anger too. You guys asked for a king, and you got what you asked for." Sort of like when they asked for meat in the wilderness instead of just manna. It says in the Psalms, it says God gave them a request, but with it, leanness of soul. God sometimes answers your prayers, even if they're not good for you, just as a judgment on you to give you what you asked for. So be careful. First of all, not to deserve that. And secondly, not to ask for things that will end up being a judgment upon you. Now, I have to say that when it says they set up kings but not of me in chapter 8, verse 4, it could be a reference to the kings of the northern kingdom that were not descended from David, that they were not God's choices of kings. But God did choose Jeroboam because a prophet came to Jeroboam before Solomon's death and told him that God's given him 10 of the tribes. So God gave them the king, Jeroboam, and God gave them Saul. But in both cases, it was because of their doing, because of their rebellion and so forth. So I gave you kings, but I was angry about it. You set up kings. It was your idea to have kings, not mine, is basically, I think, what he's saying there. And therefore, he's got a complaint against that. In chapter 9, and verse 15, he says, "All their wickedness is in Gilgal, for there I hated them." Now, that's where Saul was made king, in Gilgal. And it's probably referring to these other references to Saul. And there's a couple of other references to Gilgal that are some more neutral in the book of Hosea, but just so you, when you see the word Gilgal in three different passages, that's where Saul was made king, and that's why God speaks negatively about it. Then there's Gibeah. Gibeah is also mentioned three times in the book. Now, Gibeah was a town in Benjamin's territory where a Levite was traveling and sought to spend the night with his concubine, and he was hosted in the home of a local. And the people of the men of Gibeah came and surrounded the house, just like the men in Sodom did, surrounded Lot's house and wanted to rape the angels that were with Lot. In this case, they wanted to rape the man, and instead he gave them his concubine. Now, a concubine was somebody you're married to, but she's a slave. She's not like a free wife. Not like a free woman, and status of slaves is a lot lower. And of course, we don't have any sympathy for slavery anymore anyway, but in those days, slavery was normal, and a slave was worth less than a person, a regular person, a free person. So she was sacrificed, and she was gang raped to death. She was dead the next morning. And the man who had her as his concubine, he picked up her body, put her on his donkey, took her home, and cut her body into 12 pieces and sent a piece each to each of the 12 tribes of Israel, which was a way of saying, anyone who does not respond to this summons, either you or your wives will be cut up into pieces like this. That's basically what the meaning was in the Middle East, to do that kind of thing. Just like when they made a covenant, they cut an animal in two and they'd pass between it and they'd say, if I do not keep this covenant, may I be cut in two just like this animal is. I mean, the dissecting of the woman into 12 pieces. We're like, okay, this is what curse will come on you people if you don't respond. And so all the people of Israel came and they went to war against Benjamin. And Benjamin was almost annihilated completely. Only a few hundred of them, I think, survived it. That's why Benjamin was always a really small tribe after that. But Gibeah was this horrible place, like Sodom, really, where these people tried to rape the guy and end up raping his concubine to death. And that's saying, basically the statements are saying that this is how Israel is now. And so Gibeah is mentioned three times in the book. A name you might not connect with anything if I didn't tell you. You could, and you could study it yourself, but some people don't. So I'm giving you a leg up. Then a couple of times, depending on what translation you're reading, if you're reading the King James or the New King James, you find the term the King Jareb. King Jareb. If you look at it, chapter 5, verse 13 is the first instance. It says, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to King Jareb. He cannot cure you nor heal you of your wound. So they sent to King Jareb. And in chapter 10, verse 6, it says, the idol also should be carried to Assyria as a present to King Jareb. Now, modern translations don't say King Jareb, but there is no King Jareb. There never was a king in Assyria named Jareb. It is definitely referring to an Assyrian king. Both passages mention him being king of Assyria, but there was no Assyrian king named that. And all modern translations that I can find have rendered it the great king, that they sent to the great king in Assyria. Now, what the verses are referring to, the first one we read, 5:13, is talking about how Israel, when they were threatened by other nations, they made a pact with Assyria. And they made sort of a, you know, a treaty with Assyria, because Assyria is big and they could protect them. But the second passage says they'll be carried away. The idol in Bethel will be carried away to King Jareb in Assyria. So even though they had looked to King of Assyria for help, he ends up being the one who destroys their nation and carries them off into captivity. But why does it say King Jareb? It's an idiosyncrasy in the Hebrew. The way it's written, the spacing between the letters can go one way or another. And one way, it makes it great king. The other way makes it, Jareb, I believe, means contentious or contention. So it could be translated the king of contention, but that doesn't make much sense. But the great king would make sense, and certainly Assyria's king was the great king of that region. This time it's Sennacherib III. Both the king of Israel and the king of Judah both sought alliances with Sennacherib in order to protect them. And neither of them came through for them. Anyway, that's who King Jareb is, if you're reading a translation that says that. Now, if you're not reading King James or New King James, it probably just says great king. So that wouldn't be so confusing. But if you got this translation, it would be confusing. Now, I want to just take a few more points here. There are several references to historical things. I won't go over those, but those are in your notes. A reference to Jacob's flight from Esau is found in chapter 12, verse 12. Jacob's wrestling with the angel or with God is mentioned in chapter 12, verses 3 and 4. God delivering them from Egypt and yet them being rebellious against him in the wilderness, that's mentioned a few times. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 4, chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, and chapter 13, verses 4 through 6. Now, also their choice of a king. We've mentioned that already. So these are looking back at Israel's history at times, first of all, better times. When Jacob, pled with God for mercy when he wrestled with him. When Jacob met God when he fled from Esau at Bethel. These were pristine times. Jacob was their ancestor. The whole nation had come out of him. And, you know, it started out with a man who did deal with God and a man who surrendered to God. But not like his descendants now, who are rebellious against God and departed from God. That's the point that's being made. also the fact that their deliverance from Egypt was followed by their rebellion against him. I might just read one of these passages. Chapter 11. Well, you know what? I'm going to read this passage later because I want to end this with with the way Paul and Matthew and others quote these passages. I'm not going to go into that right now. One point I want to make before I get to the New Testament application of these verses is in the notes, it's point number 8, that Assyria is likened to a new Egypt for Israel. Israel was delivered from Egypt, from slavery, and God established them as a nation. And he told them they'd never see the Egyptians again. That's what Moses told them. You know, take one last look, you'll never see these people again, because they're going to be wiped out in the Red Sea. Well, Hosea says, well, they are going to go back to Egypt now. But it sounds like a contradiction, but then he makes it clear, when I say Egypt, I mean Assyria. We'll see that that's what he says. But the point here is that they're going to go into captivity again as they had been in Egypt. It's going to be like a second Egypt for them. Assyria is going to be a replay, in a way, of Egypt. So we see, for example, in chapter 7 and verse 16, he says, they return, but not to the Most High. They are like a deceitful bull. Their princes shall fall by the sword for their cursings of their tongue. This shall be their derision in the land of Egypt. So it makes it clear that they're going to be in Egypt again. But it's not actually Egypt, as we shall find out, that he's talking about. In chapter 8 and verse 13, it says, for the sacrifices of my offerings, they sacrifice flesh and eat it. But the Lord does not accept them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. They shall return to Egypt. Okay, so sounds like they're going to go back to Pharaoh's land, as where they had begun as a nation. Chapter 9 and verse 3, he says, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt, and they shall eat unclean things in Assyria. Now, here we see kind of a mixing of Egypt and Assyria, but then the final reference to it is in chapter 11 and verse 5, where it says, he shall not return to the land of Egypt, but the Assyrians shall be his king. So he said earlier, you're going to go back to Egypt. You're going to go back to Egypt. And I said, you're not going back to Egypt. You're going to Assyria. So he's basically saying, when I said you're going back to Egypt, I'm speaking figuratively. You're really going to Assyria. It's going to be your new Egypt. It's going to be like you're unborn. The nation was born out of Egypt. They were just a bunch of related people in Egypt. They weren't even a nation. God brought them out of Egypt, and with that deliverance came their establishment as a nation at Mount Sinai. They were born out of Egypt. Now they're going to die in Egypt, or as it were, they're going to be unborn. They're not really going back to Egypt, just Assyria, but that's going to be the end of them. That kingdom is going to be no more. It'll be as if they hadn't been born. He might as well have left them in Egypt because they're in a state just as bad, a non-existence as a nation anymore. Okay, now, I wanted to bring out four particular verses in Hosea that are very important verses and that are quoted importantly in the New Testament. But I already pointed out one of these examples, and that's in the beginning when he talks about they who were not my people will be called my people, those who had not obtained mercy will be obtained mercy. The quotation there was Romans chapter 9, verses 25 and 26, and also 1 Peter 2:10. We already looked at that, so I won't take the time for that now. The next case is a very interesting one. Hosea 11:1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Now, the last half of that verse might sound familiar. If you've ever even started reading through the New Testament, you only have to get through the first two chapters to encounter this prophecy. Matthew chapter 2, when Jesus' parents had to flee from Herod so that the baby would not be killed with the other infants in Bethlehem, they went into Egypt. And Matthew said that it might be fulfilled, which was written in the prophet, I called my son out of Egypt, or out of Egypt I called my son. It's a quote from Hosea 11:1. Now here's what's interesting. Hosea 11:1 is not a prophecy. It's a historical reminiscence. It says, when Israel was young, I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. Talk about the Exodus. Remember, before the Exodus, God said to Pharaoh, Israel's my firstborn. If you don't let Israel go, I'll kill your firstborn. So God owned Israel as his son, and they were in Egypt, and God called them out of Egypt. And we know it's talking about that because as we read the next verses, it says, as they called them, so they went from them, they sacrificed to the Baals and burned incense and carved images. I taught Ephraim to walk. And he was a child. In the infancy of the nation, in the infancy of Israel, they were brought out of Egypt, and then God taught them to walk by giving his laws, of course. By giving them laws, he taught them how to walk as no other nation had been taught to walk, and so forth. He's reminiscing about the Exodus. He's not predicting anything. There's no predictions in this. And you know, Matthew quotes it as if it's a prediction that the Messiah will come out of Egypt as God's son. How does Matthew justify that? Well, Matthew, by the way, is right. And remember, it says in Luke chapter 24 that when Jesus rose from the dead, he met with his apostles. Matthew would be one of them. And it says he opened their understanding that they might understand the scriptures. That'd be the Old Testament scriptures. There was no New Testament. Jesus gave the apostles the ability after the resurrection of Christ to correctly understand what the scriptures in the Old Testament were saying. Now, this doesn't look like a prophecy at all. It's just a reminiscence. There's many of them like it in the Old Testament. God reminded them, I brought you out of Egypt. I brought you out of Egypt. But here the wording is, out of Egypt, I called my son. And since Matthew has made it very clear, Jesus is the Son of God, and he had to go to Egypt and therefore come out of Egypt later. Israel, it is assumed by the New Testament writers, is a type of Christ. Israel was God's firstborn in the Old Testament. Jesus is God's firstborn in the New Testament. By the way, in the Isaianic passages, which we call the servant songs, Israel was the servant of Yahweh. In the New Testament, Christ is identified by the citation of those very passages as the servant of Yahweh. In the Old Testament, Israel is the vine. In the New Testament, Christ is the true vine. In the Old Testament, Israel is the seed of Abraham. In the New Testament, Christ is the seed of Abraham, according to Galatians 3:16. In other words, Israel is the type of Christ. What happened to Israel happened to Christ. Matthew is not saying that this was a prediction. He's saying it's a type. God brought Israel out of Egypt in its infancy as a nation. He did the same thing with the Messiah. There's a connection. It's intentional. He's not playing fast and loose with the scriptures. He's showing us something that I think all the apostles understood and knew. Namely, that what was true of Israel in the Old Testament and many things said about Israel are actually fulfilled in Christ. And many of the things in Israel's history are paralleled in Christ's history. After all, remember, when Jesus was baptized, he went into the wilderness and was tempted for 40 days. Israel went through the Red Sea, which Paul likens to baptism in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 through 5. He says they were baptized in the sea. In the Red Sea. When Israel was baptized, as it were, they went 40 years into the wilderness to be tempted, to be tested. Jesus, only 40 days. He didn't have 40 years to spare, but the nation was, it was baptized, and then it went through 40 days of testing in the wilderness. Jesus was baptized. He went 40 days of testing in the wilderness. And there's a number of things in the life of Jesus that parallel that of Israel. It's not accidental. Israel was a type of Christ. God called Israel out of Egypt. God called Christ out of Egypt in his infancy. And that's what Matthew is pointing out. Now, by the way, I had a caller call me on the air the other day. He says, you know, Jesus fulfilled 300 prophecies literally when he was here the first time. Why don't you think that all the prophecies about his second coming will be literal? In other words, why am I not a premillennialist and a dispensationalist? That's what he's asking. And I said, well, I don't believe you were right in the first statement that Jesus fulfilled 300 prophecies literally. The truth is, Jesus probably did fill about 300 prophecies. That's how many people have identified. But he didn't do it literally. Hosea 11:1 is not a literal fulfillment. Hosea didn't say, the Messiah will come out of Egypt. Hosea said, Israel came out of Egypt. Matthew interpreted typologically, not literally. It wasn't a literal prediction that was literally fulfilled. It was something else. A group of scholars, graduate students, I think, from Dallas Theological Seminary, actually went through all the prophecies, or at least a large number of the sampling of the prophecies that Jesus fulfilled in the New Testament, and tested, they said one out of three were literally fulfilled. The others were all fulfilled typologically or symbolically or metaphorically. For example, in Matthew chapter 2, where we have this quoted, there are four prophecies said to be fulfilled in Matthew 2. One of them is that he'd be born in Bethlehem. That was literal. The next one, or at least one of the next ones, was that, I think the next one was that Rachel wept in her grave, as Jeremiah says, when the babies in Bethlehem were slain. Well, Rachel didn't really come to life in her grave and weep in her tomb. That's a figure of speech. But Matthew says it was fulfilled when the babies were killed in Bethlehem. This is another one. Herod killed, they fled to Egypt, and that fulfilled what this said. Out of Egypt I call my son. Certainly not a literal prediction and fulfillment. And then the last verse in Matthew 2 says that he moved to Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled what was said in the prophets, he should be called a Nazarene. There's not one place in the prophets where Jesus is said to be a Nazarene. There's no prediction like that. But several of the prophets did say the Messiah would be called the branch, and Nazareth means the town of the branch. So Matthew is saying, you know, the prophets, plural, called him the branch, and what do you know? He grew up in the town of the branch, which is what a Nazarene is, someone from Nazareth. So these are interesting ways in which Matthew and other New Testament writers saw fulfillment of Old Testament texts in the life of Christ. But even of those four, only one of those four was literal. And we take the larger number, about one out of three are literal, the other two thirds are something else. Okay, now let's take another one. Chapter 6, Hosea 6:6. This is a wonderful verse. Jesus quotes it twice. He says, "For I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings." See, the knowledge of God is one of those things that God several times complains that they lack. He wants them to know God more than he wants their burnt offerings. He wants them to have mercy, not just offer sacrifices. You see, they did offer sacrifices, as it turns out, to golden calves, but religion is not what God loves most. Offering sacrifices is religion. What he loves most is, you know, godly character, mercy, being merciful, knowing God. Now, Jesus quoted this twice. It's interesting. In Matthew chapter 9, when his disciples were accused of breaking the Sabbath by rubbing grain in their hands on the Sabbath and eating the kernels that were separated thereby from the chaff, when the criticism came, Jesus said to the Pharisees who were doing the criticizing, Matthew 9:13, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice." Now, he said, "Go and learn what this means." Scholars agree that this was a way that the Pharisees themselves, the rabbis, would preface a statement when they were going to quote a verse to somebody who asked what they thought was a stupid question. In other words, this was, "Oh, Rabbi," some unlearned person, "Oh, Rabbi, you know, what must I do, you know, in this situation?" And if the law had already addressed it, the Pharisees would say, "Go and learn what that means." And they'd quote the verse, like, "Don't you know anything?" So Jesus turns it back on them. "You go and learn what this means. Hosea 6:6, I will have mercy and not sacrifice." Well, then if you look at chapter 12 of Matthew, they're criticizing him again because he's eating with tax collectors and sinners. And in chapter 12, verse 7, it says, Jesus said, "But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guilty." So I told you to go and learn what this means. Apparently you didn't do your homework because you still don't know what it means. If you had known what this means, you would have condemned the guilty. What's he saying? He's saying that ritual religion, which is what set off Israel from other nations more than anything else, circumcision, keeping the Sabbath, the temple rituals that God gave them in Leviticus, all that ritual, the unclean foods that they would avoid, those were laws that separated them from the Gentiles. The Gentiles, some Gentiles would avoid murder and adultery, not perfectly, certainly, no nation has, even Israel didn't, but most of the laws of pagan nations forbade murder and theft and things like that. Some of those things were in the law of Moses. The moral laws were the common things God requires of everybody. But the ceremonial laws were only for Israel, and that's what they took their boast in. We are circumcised, not like the uncircumcised. We keep the Sabbath, not like these pagans who don't keep the Sabbath. You know, we don't eat these unclean foods like the pagans. They boasted in their ceremonial cleanness and the special laws that God gave them that he didn't give other people. And God says in Hosea, these sacrifices, this all this stuff, this ceremonial worship that you boast in, I don't care about that as much as I care in you being merciful, as much as I care in you knowing me. In other words, the inward life of holiness, the inward life of godliness, the being just and merciful. You know, Jesus said in Matthew 23:23 to the Pharisees, you hypocrites, you pay your tithe of mint and anise and cumin, which is keeping ceremonial law of tithing for the sake of the temple. He says, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These things you should have done and not left the other undone. God cares more. They're weightier matters of the law. What's weightier? Not the tithing and the sacrifices and the unclean food avoidance and the circumstances. Those are not the weighty matters. Those are ceremonies, all of them. What matters to God is justice and mercy and faithfulness. What he wants is righteousness in the character. That's what Hosea says. That's essentially what Micah said, also in a very famous verse, Micah 6:8. For the people are asking, what does God require of me? Shall I sacrifice rivers of oil? Shall I bring 1,000 goats and bulls? Shall I sacrifice my own son? They're making it sound like God's really demanding. Like, what do you want from me anyway? And all the things they suggest are ritual. And Micah says, he showed you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, that you do justly, that you love mercy, that you walk humbly with your God. These are the things that God wants. David himself said, sacrifice and offerings you did not desire, but a broken and contrite spirit. You know, God has, even the Old Testament prophets and David knew that all these rituals were not what God was excited about. He's excited about goodness, righteousness, justice, mercy, faithfulness, humility. And that's what Hosea is one of the places. In fact, Hosea is the one that Jesus chose to quote a couple times to make that point. So the only thing I have left, and I've got 5 minutes, is chapter 14. Now, chapter 14 is the last chapter of Hosea, and it's also one of the restoration passages. O Israel, return to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take words with you and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity. Receive us graciously, for we will offer the sacrifice of our lips, not animal sacrifices, but our praises to God. That term, sacrifice of the lips, refers to the same thing as Hebrews chapter 13. I think it's verse 13, if I'm not mistaken, where the writer says, let us offer up the fruit of our lips, the sacrifice of praise, thanksgiving to God. That idea of the fruit of the lips is here, not animals. Assyria shall not save us. We will not ride on horses, nor will we say any more to the work of our hands, you are our God. For in you the fatherless finds mercy. Now, that's what he tells them to do and to say. That's the change of heart he's requiring of them. Then he says, he promises, I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely. For my anger has turned away from him. I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall grow like the lily. Remember Jesus said in Matthew 6:28, consider the lilies, how they grow. How do they grow? Well, they don't toil or spin. They don't worry. Grow like that. Grow by not worrying, by trusting God. Consider the lilies, how they grow. He says that Israel should grow like the lily. Well, so do we if we follow Christ's instructions. And lengthen his roots like Lebanon. His branches shall spread. His beauty shall be like an olive tree. Yeah, as Paul called it in Romans 11. And his fragrance like Lebanon. Those who dwell under the shadow, his shadow shall return. They shall be revived like grain and grow like the vine. Their scent shall be like the wine of Lebanon. Now, of course, these are all agrarian images. Very common in all the prophets, actually, or at least most of them. It's a very common thing in the prophets for agrarian images of blessing to be used. Every man shall sit under his vine and his fig tree. Just means he'll be secure. And it'll be at peace. He'll be unafraid. This doesn't have to be fulfilled in an agrarian way. And it's interesting how often Jesus would take images from farming and use them in his parables. A sower went out to sow, or, you know, and then there's someone threw pears in there, or, you know, a man planted a mustard seed and it grew. And I mean, these are spiritual images, just like God was looking for fruit from the vine, Israel. He's looking for justice and righteousness, what he said in Isaiah 5:7. That's the fruit he wanted. Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit, but fruit and fruitfulness is a very common image in the New Testament. By the way, if you happen to read this book, I've got chapter on that very fact and its significance to the kingdom of God. Ephraim shall say, what have I to do anymore with idols? I have heard and observed him. I am like a green cypress tree. Your fruit is found in me. Now this definitely sounds like Jesus. First of all, your fruit is found in me. Jesus said, every branch in me that abides in me shall bear much fruit. I'm the vine, you're the branches. You'll remain in me and you'll bear fruit. Your fruit is in me. Clearly referring to this imagery here. When it says in that verse earlier, in the middle of verse 8, I have heard and observed him. This is what they'll be saying. I have heard and observed him. That's what John said. In John chapter 1, verse 14, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. We saw him. In 1 John chapter 1, verse 20 says, that which we have seen, which we've heard, which we've looked upon, and our hands have handled of the Word of life, that which we've seen and heard, we declare unto you. He's talking about we saw him, we touched him, we heard him. Like Job, at the end of the book of Job, when he sees God, he says, I've heard of you at the hearing of the ears, but now my eye sees you, and I loathe myself and repent in dust and ashes. So Israel repenting because they now see him. When do they see him? It says in John chapter 1, no man has seen God at any time, but the only begotten of the Father has revealed him. And certainly Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So at what point in time can it be said, we've seen him? Well, when Jesus came and was seen by Israel. Who is wise? Let him understand these things. Who is prudent? Let him know them. Now, this is kind of interesting because Paul says that the gospel he preached was that which was not known to the sons of men, but had been revealed to himself and, he says, the holy apostles and prophets through the Spirit. That an understanding was being given to them that was not before. And he says, well, who can understand these things? Who is wise and understands them? For the ways of the Lord are right, the righteous walk in them, but transgressors shall stumble in them. Now, what this basically says, it's a short chapter and a short messianic passage. Basically, God's going to bless his people, the true remnants of Israel, who follow Christ, with fruitfulness. Like a vine, like a fig tree, like grain. All these things are simple. I mean, grain? Paul said to the Corinthians, he said, I planted and Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. Talk about grain. He says, for we are laborers together with God, me and Apollos, but he says that you are God's field. Likening the church to a field of grain. He says, I planted it, Apollos came and watered it, God gave the increase. Apollos and I are laborers in the field, but you're the field. The church is the field of grain. One of the parables of Jesus in Mark 4, he said, the kingdom of God is as if a man would sow seed in his field, and he would sleep and wake, and the seed grew, and he knows not how. He says, for the earth itself produces the grain. First the blade, then the head, then the full grain in the head. He's comparing the kingdom, which is the colony of Christians on the planet, with a growing stalk of grain to produce the fruit of wheat in this case. All these agricultural images are picked up by Jesus and Paul and applied to the church. Then, of course, it's most important in verses 8 and 9, or especially 8, it talks about how the people of God will have actually had him revealed to them. They will have seen him, and they will bear fruit, because their fruit is in him. The way that Jesus used these images in his teaching make it almost impossible to imagine that he's not thinking of this passage and others like it. So, again, we have the high points of almost any prophet are not the times when they predict the fall of Tyre, the fall of Babylon, and it comes true just the way they said it did. Those are great. We love those things to impress people with how history has fulfilled prophecy. But the real important passages of the prophets are those that are messianic, the ones that speak of what God will ultimately do by sending a king, by sending the Messiah, by establishing his reign, which is established when he was seated at the right hand of God, the Father. 2,000 years ago, he still reigns. He still is reigning over us now. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, and he must reign until he's put all his enemies under his feet. So Christ is reigning now, and he'll continue to reign until he's finished with his conquest. Jesus said in Revelation 3, 3:20, to him that overcomes, I will allow to sit with me on my throne, even as I have overcome and am seated with my Father on his throne. In other words, I'm already enthroned. I'm going to let you sit with me on my throne with me if you overcome. But he's enthroned. He's the king. He's the king of kings, Lord of lords. And we will reign with him. And all these passages in the Old Testament speak of it. We wouldn't know that they're symbolic if the apostles and Jesus didn't quote them and apply them to their own time. So since they did, we are given greater insight, just like they were given greater insight to the Old Testament scriptures.